Shine and 42 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's wall-to-wall sports on today's program. We begin with a conversation about a beloved sports-related event in Kenosha that celebrates its 60th anniversary this year, just as it undergoes some dramatic changes. In part two, an interview from the archives just in time for Sunday's big Super Bowl, a look back at the history of the Super Bowl with one of the authors of Super Bowl Gold. Here's part one. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about something that's been quite an institution here in the Kenosha community, namely Holy Rosary's Sports Night, which has been around for decades and on a number of occasions has meant visits from some really big, big names in the world of athletics and sports. And it's always been an event that was about celebrating athletic endeavors and athletic excellence, and particularly supporting and lifting up and celebrating the great young athletes in our community. We have two people who are the co-chairs of Holy Rosary's Sports Night, Greg Powell and Tony Galici. And I invited them to come onto the program because Holy Rosary's Sports Night is changing gears in fairly dramatic fashion from the way it has been sort of doing business over the last several decades. And we're going to be talking about some of the things that have prompted this and the way in which they are intending to move forward and to do some exciting things, but a bit different from the way Sports Night has been in the past. Greg Powell, Tony Galici, we welcome both of you to the Morning Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Glad that you can be here. So before we talk about what's changing, I think it would be interesting to kind of sketch out for our listeners, particularly for the sake of folks not from Kenosha, who might not know anything about this amazing legacy, who wants to kind of summarize the history of Holy Rosary's Sports Night?
So in 1954, parishioners had an idea to do a testimonial dinner to raise funds for the school and eventually down the road the athletic programs. But in 1954, they had a testimonial dinner for Dan Buccioroni, who was the heavyweight contender for a heavyweight boxing title.
Wow.
Back then. They started that process by bringing in athletes. In the second annual, they brought in Alan Amici, and our trophy that our athletes receive is named after Alan Amici. Then he went on to Chuck Jaskiewicz, a very well-regarded high school football coach in Kenosha. They then looked at saying, you know what, let's go back to the celebrity route, and they were lucky to get some boxer named Rocky Marciano.
wow.
And they were very successful in doing that in 1957. And over the years, they continued to bring in professional-type athletes to the program. And in 1957, they introduced the Outstanding Catholic Male Athlete Award. So you had to be an Italian male Catholic athlete, and they selected that in 1957. Over the years, they changed that, and they went to just the Outstanding Male Athlete. And they did that for many years. And after the 25th annual, the committee decided to add the female athlete to the docket. So for 25 years then, we had the male and the female athlete. And that was just the city of Kenosha. And after the 50th, we had a lot of inquiries about why don't we include the county schools in that selection. We talked it over with our selection committee. And for the 51st annual, we added the county schools. So to date, we include all 8 county high schools in our selection. Up until last year, still did the celebrity guests that we were able to secure. So that kind of was the how the program evolved from a testimonial dinner to raise funds for the parish to a full-blown sports night where we brought in professional athletes, recognized our high school athletes. And those proceeds still benefited our athletic programs at Holy Rosary up until 10 years ago when they did the consolidation with All Saints. And it helped with our athletic facilities that we had.
Right. So what was the process by which these outstanding athletes would be chosen? I mean, whoever would be named in a given year, what are we talking about in terms of that selection process?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting process. We have actually an independent selection committee. The committee is independent from the Holy Rosary Executive Committee that runs Sports Night. So the committee is comprised of maybe retired athletic directors, you know, other high school, or not high school, but college coaches, you know, people in that kind of genre of work, if you will, people that know sports, are dialed into, you know, local, you know, high school action athletes, you know, different sports and things like that. And those guys come together. We invite them to Holy Rosary for actually a selection day. And typically had been done in December. That's going to change now that the program's changing a little bit. But we'll still keep that formula. And all of the athletic directors present their best of the best from their particular high school after, you know, local discussion with coaches and teachers and whatnot, because there is an application process for selecting the athlete in terms of, you know, not only prowess on the field in a particular sport or sports, but also academics and community service. And that's all considered, you know, as like the entire package, you know, when selecting the top high school male and female athlete of the year. So they all go through the process and kind of vote, if you will. Typically, somebody from the selection committee steps up to lead the process, and we walk away with a male winner and a female winner, and then the communication with them goes on from there.
So this is an award that actually awards more than just athletic excellence itself, but you're really wanting to lift up athletes who are also terrific young citizens, if you will, in the community.
Absolutely. It's a big part of it.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic. You touched on just a couple of the big names. Do you want to name a couple of the others that have been really fun guests who were part of this over the years?
So for those that know their sports, we had some guy named Joe Gargiola.
Wow.
Who was a big sportscaster back in the late 50s.
And a catcher before that, I think, right? Yeah.
We had a quarterback from Green Bay in 1960 called named Bart Starr.
Really?
we were fortunate enough to secure Bart Starr. A lot of people think in 1963 was one of our marquee programs with Hank Aaron, Mike Ditka, John McHale, Ray Nitschke, Fuzzy Thurston. Just an all-star lineup. When you see a lot of the pictures of Sports Night, you see that picture a lot.
Yeah.
We had Dick Butkus and Bob Gibson in 1968, along with Fergie Jenkins, Pete Rose in 1970, Joe Torre, Franco Harris, George Foster, Joe Montana. So you're seeing a lot of names you typically wouldn't see in this area.
Right.
And
right.
We were able to do that, or they were. I wasn't on that committee back then. They were able to do that because one of the committee members was a writer for the Chicago Daily News, Pete Turkle. And when he would interview these athletes, he would say, "Hey, what are you doing in February? We have an event in Kenosha. Would you be willing to come?"
Sure.
And he had a way of talking these guys into doing it.
Wow, wow. Well, as your news release indicated, we're kind of living in a different world now. And the world of professional sports is not what it once was, particularly not the way it was 50 years ago when all of this started. So tell me about the conversations that have taken place more recently in terms of that, those kind of changes, and what's prompted you then to kind of shift the focus of this event.
Yeah, I can start out a little bit here. You know, it's interesting how it's evolved with the teams themselves, the professional sports teams. I like to kind of describe it as there's kind of this moat that's sort of built around these teams. Whereas in the past, it's been a lot easier perhaps to, you know, get to, you know, the team organizers, maybe the personnel person, you know, et cetera. Now there's all types of barriers and things like that to actually getting into the team and making some sort of a contact. As it's kind of evolved over the years, we've been pretty lucky that we've had some key people that have had maybe some experience in doing some events, you know, in addition to ours, and they have access to, like, guys in the Chicago Bears, maybe the Green Bay Packers, so on and so forth. But as that kind of evolved, it even became a little bit more difficult for them to procure athletes, and that trickled down to us, and you know, and so on goes the story.
Yeah.
Even thinking about college athletes, Al DeSimone, one of our charter members, he was he's actually on the UW Board of Regents for quite some time. Mm. And actually, didn't he help fund the quarterback scholarship mm-hmm. for the UW Badgers? And, you know, so there was always that in and somebody that was willing to do Al a favor to get us somebody from Wisconsin.
Sure.
Well, you know, as, you know, time went on and, you know, unfortunately Al passed away, you know, several years ago, those types of contacts meant a lot. And when they fall away, mm-hmm. despite trying to kind of keep them going, it became more difficult. In addition to some of the NCAA rule changes that mm-hmm. they got very skittish on and whatnot and try to kind of keep us at a little bit of an arm's distance. And more recently, the image and likeness rules, where actually college athletes can get paid for their time and effort and appearances and things like that, which is something that we didn't necessarily have to contend with years
right.
ago.
Right, yeah. There's a whole lot of things that kind of come together, don't it? So describe what Sports Night is going to be going forward from here.
So what we'll be doing, we will still be selecting the athletes of the year. Athletic directors will receive their application notice sometime in March. We give them 6 or 8 weeks to put that together. They'll turn those into us. We'll disseminate those to the committee. Committee will review them for a couple weeks, formulate their questions. We bring the selection committee and the athletic directors together on May 18th. They will ask their questions of the athletic directors, have to clarify what maybe some of the activities some of the students were in, some of the extracurricular activities that they were in. And the committee will make a recommendation on who they feel the athletes are. And some years we've had co-winners. Mm. Other years we've had one winner. So it's not unusual to have co-winners at the event. They have a scoring system that nobody from Sports Night knows or understands or
sure.
cares to know.
Right,
That's their way of doing it. We give them the information. They put their system in place and they do their stuff behind closed doors. We facilitate it.
Right.
That's all we do. And we announce it once that happens. So once they select those winners, we'll work out with the high schools how we actually make that announcement. In years past, we would let that athlete know right there that afternoon that they were the winner and get ready for sports night because it was coming 6 weeks down the road. We'll work at the high schools, maybe do some type of an announcement at their senior awards banquet or an assembly they may have.
Sure.
And work it in through there. We'll also do it on our Facebook page and our website to get the word out. So I think it's, while it's a little different, I think we owe it to the community to keep this tradition going.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a tradition that started back in 1957. People still talk about the award, those that maybe have won it, those that thought maybe they should have won it and didn't, and why they should have won it.
Right.
But I think it's a tradition well deserved, and we're going to do our best part to keep it rolling.
I think that is a very, very laudable goal, and I can tell, you know, how thoughtfully you have approached this, and I think it makes all the sense in the world, and glad to see that Sports Night is going forward from here. So, Tony Galici and Greg Powell, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and best wishes going forward with Holy Rosary Sports Night. You're listening to The Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program is an interview from the archives recorded and initially broadcast back in 2015. Well, if there is a football fan for whom you need to purchase a gift this holiday season, I heartily recommend a magnificent new book that is just out from Sports Illustrated called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. It looks back over the near half century of Super Bowls that have been played over the decades, and it helps chart the history of the game. And one of the things that we come away from as we see this book is how drastically the game has changed. That is, the Super Bowl itself, how drastically it has changed from that first Super Bowl waged back in 1967 when the Packers defeated the Chiefs in resounding fashion. There is very little about that game that could perhaps possibly have foretold just the incredible extravaganza which it would eventually become. Austin Murphy has done very, very good work in the beautifully written introduction which adorns this book, and he's here to tell us more about it. Once again, it's titled Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game, and it comes to us from Sports Illustrated, where he is a senior writer. Austin Murphy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. That was well done, and we appreciate the kind words. I'm right with you. It's astonishing to look back. Time has really flown. One of my favorite pictures, for purposes of comparing, you know, where we are and where we've been, was on the right-hand page. This is early on. There is a snapshot of, I think it was just a media day, which has turned into this frenzy with, you know, several thousand correspondents, and in some ways, it's sort of it's an apt metaphor. Or a reflection of what the game has become. It is excess embodied. And on the page next to it, there's Joe Namath in, I guess, what would be the 60s equivalent of board shorts. And he's, he's talking to a few journalists. I think it's on the beach in outside the Fountain Blue Hotel. And it was right around the time he was guaranteeing victory. The Jets' victory over the Colts, which in fact he pulled off. He had just a kind of an ordinary game, but the Jets did beat the Colts, and it lent the game a lot of legitimacy. But they were certainly simpler times.
Absolutely. There is one lone television man with a microphone in Mr. Namath's face and a rather antiquated-looking TV camera we see in the foreground of the picture, and a scattering of a few people in the background. And you're right, the opposite page of that spread shows a modern-day media day for the Super Bowl, and it is a mass of humanity. And right there, in a nutshell, is one very clear sense of how this game has become what somebody, I think it was you, said is now an international cultural extravaganza. As you look over this history, how much of your feelings about that are regret? That is, do you spend a lot of time regretting that what was in the beginning a fairly simple game between two great football teams has become this other thing? I mean, do you regret that at all? Not that you're responsible for it, but...
No, I think there was a time, perhaps when I was younger, when there would be resentment at, for instance, being sent into media day with instructions to, you know, find a fresh angle or try to get somebody by themselves, and it's just impossible. And I think now I'm just more, you walk into it and let the experience wash over you and kind of appreciate and not feel one way or the other about it. It's just, it is what it is, and it's where we are. It's interesting. I was the college football writer at Sports Illustrated for a decade or more in the aughts. I've had a couple of turns doing college football, and wrote a book called Saturday Rules, really making the case for why the college game is more fun than, you know, the corporate colossus NFL, the no fun league. It's huge, anodyne, impersonal, and yet our focus groups repeatedly have told us that people cannot get enough of the NFL, and so here I am, and I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm just I'm finding the stories in each locker room and making human connections, and grateful to have a job in print media in the year 2015.
Right. In your introduction called The Fantastic Voyage, which I think is beautifully written and really, really fascinating, you quote somebody as calling the Super Bowl America's last great Campfire. I think it was a marketing officer from the NFL. You must think that's an interesting quote if you include it in your introduction. What do you think Mr. Waller is getting to when he characterizes the Super Bowl in this way, as America's last great campfire?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for the kind words. I remember making the point right around that place in the essay. I used that quote just to make the point that this game in particular, this event, has long since sort of transcended sport, achieved escape velocity. It is now, it's a global event. So we marvel at it for that reason alone, and how far it's come from that, you know, that first Super Bowl, which was really just a glorified exhibition game between, you know, the two champions of different leagues. What happens in every Super Bowl, the sort of things that we remember and talk about become a national currency. You know, the Monday, and for years and decades afterward, they're commemorated in books like this one and on NFL films. We're not just talking about what happened during the game, and hopefully we got a good game. Half the time you get a pretty good game, and 25% of the time I think you get a dog game or a rout, and the other times, like last year, you get a really good game, and that actually lives up to the hype. But it doesn't have to live up to the hype, because it is also a discussion about the Super Bowl halftime show. I have another essay in the book talking about the evolution of the halftime show, which was a lot of fun. The film festival, that is the discussion over, you know, who had the best commercial, and who did what kind of a job on the national anthem. So there's a lot going on aside from, you know, what happened on third and long.
Mm-hmm. I am intrigued by some of the photographs that capture that very first Super Bowl, which I think you remind us was not even called a Super Bowl at the time. That name got attached a little bit later. But among the most striking things is to see just the smattering of fans that are in the stands. I mean, it appears like there weren't all that many people in attendance to see the Packers beat the Chiefs. And of course, that's in very stark contrast to what we see now, where it's probably one of the hardest tickets in all the world to get.
It is. And I know that I think the opening double truck photograph is from the first Super Bowl, and it's the captains are meeting midfield, and it's deliberately, there's this ocean of turf around them. There's only one zebra out there. You know, now there would be television cameras, and it would be a production unto itself. And it's quite deliberate, just to show you, it reflects how small bore it was compared to where we are now. The point is well taken.
Right. I appreciate another point made in your introduction, in which you try to explain why there is this ferocious intensity when it comes to our fascination to the Super Bowl, our interest in it. Even people who otherwise are not particularly interested in professional football, but who find themselves drawn to this game. Not every single person, but of course a whole lot of people just cannot stay away. One of the points you make in your introduction is by contrasting the way the NFL figures out its ultimate championship with, for instance, Major League Baseball or the National Basketball Association. It's a relatively obvious point, and yet one that I don't think is all that often made or as clearly as you make it. What is it about the Super Bowl that stands apart from these other professional sports leagues?
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, and it did seem self-evident. Anyway, what you're getting at is that these other championships, these are best of seven series, and football, the beauty of football is that it is, it's one game. It's a one-off. How are you going to do on this particular day? So we will decide a champion not over the next 2 weeks, but over the next 3.5 hours, like 4 hours with the added commercials and halftime. And so it's the drama is distilled. But on, you know, to be completely honest, you know, another thing that makes the game more picante for a lot of viewers is the fact that they have money on the game, or they bought a square, you know, the NFL doesn't, you know, prefers not to talk about it, but, you know, a lot of people have action on the Super Bowl that jacks up its appeal as well.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Austin Murphy, who's responsible for the introduction to a really magnificent new book from Sports Illustrated called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. I think the way this book is put together is really quite ingenious. And I think it's terrific the way we sort of can attack this game from a lot of different angles. Can you just tell us who had a hand in the construction of the overall book and in, you know, making the decisions about the different elements that are represented here?
Yeah, you know, these are colleagues of mine, former SI editors. What's going on is that in print media, we're really, over the last decade or so, we've been really challenged to find different ways. It's a more challenging environment, so now we're doing more books. We're looking inward and seeing that we actually have some fantastic resources, in the Sports Illustrated Library. It's humbling for a writer to admit, but this book is carried by amazing photography. And I'm always, I'll see the photographers before the game. I like to take a lap during warm-up, say an hour before, even if it's cold, and maybe overhear something. Rarely you'll get something in the notebook that you can use for your game story, but I'm always running into our photographers down there, and I've seen these people for decades, and it's often, we will exchange good-natured abuse because they believe that my job is easier because I can actually miss something and then catch up on it, you know, debrief the players and coaches afterwards. But if they miss the game-winning touchdown, it's a big problem. They've always done magnificent work. It's called Sports Illustrated for a reason. To your point, it's they decided to break the book into quarters, so each sort of epoch of the league is, you know, we get Super Bowls 1 through X11 in the first quarter, 8 through XX1V in the next quarter. And as you can see, another of the things that I don't care for about the NFL is these Roman numerals. please, can we do away with the Roman numerals? I think, you know, they were sort of putting on airs early on. It's like they wanted to invest it with a dignity or something. But
grandiosity that in the early going it maybe didn't have, or people didn't see the grandiosity. And
yeah, now we're fine. Now you're fine, and you can get rid of it. It's like adding, spelling your shop with a OPPE. you're trying a little too hard. We don't need the Roman numerals.
Right.
Well, maybe I could just learn them and I'd stop complaining about
them. It's probably one of the only facets of modern American life where we still use Roman numerals. Also in the book, we have space devoted to each and every Super Bowl and an excerpt from the Sports Illustrated article written at the time, another little interesting column called Just the Facts, which includes important statistics from the game, and always a photograph of that particular Super Bowl ring, what the Sports Illustrated cover looked like. And another thing I really appreciate, and I suspect you do too, is with each and every chapter, there is something called The Way It Was, in which we hear from two different players and I suppose occasionally a coach, who were directly involved in the game. One from the winning team, one from the losing team. And I so appreciate this facet because somehow it brings the game alive on a whole different level by allowing us to hear from two of the gladiators who were directly involved?
I'm so glad that you brought that up, and that was a lot of work for people to go, you know, to work the phones and find somebody from each game and debrief them and get an extra vignette or snapshot. I was just, you know, from last year's game, we have the hero, the cornerback, the Patriots cornerback Malcolm Butler, talking about how earlier in the week running against the scout team offense down on the goal line, they had run the same look slant pattern that the Seahawks called with, you know, infamously now, notoriously. And Malcolm Butler was beat on the play, and he talks about how Coach Belichick walked up to him and said, you got to get that. And so when it was real, you know, I watched Malcolm Butler, and I remember how aggressively he played that pass and how he just took the ball away. And it's just a nice few brush strokes that I hadn't gotten anywhere else. And so thanks for bringing that up.
Do you have time for just a couple more questions?
Please.
I want to mention the fact that at the end of the book, there is a ranking of all of the Super Bowls from best to worst. And this is a really interesting list. And, of course, it's sure to generate all kinds of disagreement, consternation amongst people who have their own Super Bowl favorite that is not ranked as highly as they believe it should be. Do you know anything about how this ranking list came about? Were you part of it, a part of the calculations? And what do you think about the list as it appears here?
I was delighted to not be included in this process. It is a formula. It's not completely subjective. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 categories. So you get points for lead changes, fourth quarter drama, whether or not the team was an underdog, historical significance, and memorable player plays. And so the number one was the Giants 17-14 win over New England in Super Bowl XL11, which, of course, is you're going to let me know as soon as possible, but it was a helmet catch by David Tyree. And if you remember, Eli Manning dropped back, and he was sacked. It looked like he was sacked three different times, and Eli incredibly showing escapability and finding David Tyree, who has since faded from the landscape. I guess my only quibble would be that even in a rout sometimes, and so the routes have all settled to the bottom, 40-49. But even in a lopsided game, for instance, the 85 Chicago Bears, so this would have been in the 86 Super Bowl, dismembered Tony Eason and the New England Patriots. But it was historic. This was the best defense, Buddy Ryan's defense for Coach Ditka. It was the best defense you've ever seen in the NFL. And so it was something, you know, you were witnessing something you would never see again, and so it didn't deserve to be. Sometimes there's a sort of rubbernecking appeal to these routes, and there have been a number of really games that were over by halftime, and which is one of the reasons that Commissioner Ozell came around to it and realized they needed a very entertaining halftime show in case, you know, the Cowboys were slaughtering the Buffalo Bills or whatever. I like the rankings. Mostly, a book like this is basically fodder for argument, trivia, you know, but sort of the barstool conversations. You gotta have lists.
Absolutely. And I appreciate your point about, and I think maybe even in your introduction, you mentioned the fact that sometimes a lopsided game like Seattle beating Denver 43-8 can be really intriguing. In this case, to see the Seattle defense humbling the great Peyton Manning. I mean, there was something really, really fascinating about that, even if the game was never close or in any doubt. I mean, it isn't always just about how close a game is fought. Sometimes there is something really fascinating in a clinical destruction of an opponent by someone who's vastly superior. Certainly in the game of tennis, sometimes a slaughter can be a really interesting thing sometimes.
There's something Shakespearean about it, and there's such a build-up. You know, this is the only game of the season for which there's a two-week build-up, which is a week too many as far as I'm concerned. And so the hype machine goes into overdrive, and the pains to, you know, the celebrations of, you know, the genius of Peyton Manning has an extra week to be amplified. And then to see him brought low, there's something perversely satisfying about that. And it wasn't just Manning, although he looked certainly didn't look like himself. I think it was the first play from scrimmage. There was a bad snap. Anyway, it was this fascinating entropy that takes place and seems to take place more often in the Super Bowl.
Absolutely. And we want to remind people that if they look at the book, you can certainly, as a Packers fan, of course, we have lots of Green Bay Packers fans listening, you can explore each and every one of the Packers' appearances in the Super Bowl. I think five in all but one ending in victories. And for Chicago Bears fans, you can see the Bears. And I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan as well. And it's, of course, really fun to read about the incredible successes which the Steelers have had in this big game. Let's finish up with your second essay, which is called Don't Touch That Dial. You briefly mentioned it earlier, in which you chart the dramatic transformation of the halftime show for the Super Bowl. I mean, in some respects, this is a perfect mirror of how the stature of the game has changed over the years. But it's also very much an indication of the excess that is also a mark of this extravaganza. On a really personal level, what do you think of this transformation of the halftime show for the Super Bowl?
Well, it was fun to do a deep dive on it, just because when I was younger and more cynical, I would think, and this is around the time we were getting we were having Up With People foisted on us. This is the kind of chipper group of young performers whose talent level ranged, between High School Variety Show and Waiting for Guffman. It was just this incomprehensible, it was busy, there was no theme, they meant well, it was too much, and it made too little sense. But what ended up happening was that there was the Super Bowl. I think Dorothy Hamill was skating around during halftime. I'm not sure how they got ice on the field.
Oh, I remember that. It was a small little circular area, and not enough to do much of anything, mostly a couple little spins. But, yeah, that was a bad miscalculation.
Well, that was the winter that Fox had counter-programmed and said, hey, listen, we all know how lame the halftime show is, so come on over to Fox for halftime. And in Living Color, they had a special show, and it was screamingly funny. It was raunchy, but the Wayans brothers. And the NFL got clobbered, and that was a turning point for them. They said, okay, we need to kind of rise above the dinner theater caliber entertainment. And I think they went out and got Diana Ross, and they started to take it more seriously. And the halftime show thereafter has been built around one, you know, mega performer, and so it's become the most watched concert of the year. And then there was, of course, the Janet Jackson reveal, the inadvertent or advertent reveal, depending on who you want to believe, after which the NFL sort of went cautious conservative. They went with, you know, a series of aging male rockers, a period of time I refer to as ARP with people, and which is kind of inside humor. And they've sort of gotten the drill down. The Madonna halftime performance was, the ratings actually bumped up during that halftime. And but they're all really chasing Michael Jackson. His I thought it bogged down at the end. There was sort of a We Are the World treacle. But in the beginning, Michael Jackson was on fire, and he put on a fantastic show out in Los Angeles.
It's a really intriguing. I find myself, as I watch the halftime show, often wondering how many football fans watching the game are enjoying this. And, you know, most of the time, I'm not. I know I'm not, but it's not my kind of music. But, of course, they're aiming for a wide swath of young America, I suppose, in the choices that they make. I just sometimes wish that, in a sense, they were aiming for something that would have even broader appeal, that, you know, my father-in-law would enjoy watching. Or right. I mean right. There's a whole lot of Americans watching this Super Bowl, and I somehow feel like this halftime extravaganza is not designed with all of us in mind, in a sense. And maybe it can't be. Maybe that's impossible.
I remember watching the Black Eyed Peas a few years ago and just thinking of my octogenarian father in Rhode Island and wondering and just thinking what he must have been thinking, which is like, when, at what point did I lose the thread here? You know, just the outfits, let alone the music. But, you know, I talked to an NFL executive VP about this, and they are the multi-generational family that goes to Vegas and is trying to find a show. Do you go to a magic show? Do you go to a Cirque du Soleil? No, that's too racy. So, you can't get it right. I think I put it something along the lines of they are trying to find entertainment that would stretch like one of Keith Richards' neck waddles across multiple demographics, and it's an impossible errand. So maybe they've stopped trying, but they were, because you're doomed to fail. And I think a lot of people aren't enjoying it, but don't forget people like me who, even if it's bad, enjoy making fun of it.
You know, there are
people at the Super Bowl party who are gathered around, you know, mocking it, and there's something to be said for that, too.
Right. Tell our listeners who Lucille Walker is. She's somebody mentioned in your very interesting essay on halftime entertainment.
Yeah, well, Lucille Walker, God bless her, is the widow of Tommy Walker, also known as Tommy the Toe, who was a child actor. His dad was a musician. He was a young musician. He's playing, he's leading the band in an old movie called Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But he was a World War II veteran who came back, and he was a hero. He matriculated at USC and was both a kicker and played in the marching band. He was the guy with the baton who led it, actually. So for extra points and field goals, he would come down from the stands, take off his Shaco hat, you know, the big hat, and kick. And he actually got a tryout offer with the Redskins, but instead took a job with Walt Disney. He was a showman, and he was the guy who first went to Pete Rozelle and said, how about if we do something special for the Super Bowl halftime? Let's have an extravaganza. And Rozelle famously said, why would we want to spend that kind of money? It's when everyone gets up to go to the bathroom. And so he won. In the early Super Bowls, I have to say, Tommy Walker had a great sense music. You know, he was the guy who brought in the fantastic marching bands from the all-black colleges in the Southwest Athletic Conference. I'm talking about Grambling and Texas Southern. And they, you know, he just had a great sense of showmanship that that they lost their way a little bit for a while, I think. And then now maybe. And so Lucille Walker, I went to visit her in Southern California, and she made the same lament, and maybe they're finding their way now.
she tells you about the Super Bowl number 4, in which Tommy's halftime show employed 20,000 balloons, 50 American flags, 3,000 pigeons, 37 muskets, and 3 cannons, all for an on-field reenactment of the Battle of New Orleans. And you quote her later in the essay as saying that what America has always been hungry for is pageantry. And I guess that's as much as anything what the modern-day Super Bowl is about.
I think Tommy's shows were, the word I was searching for earlier was coherence. The Super Bowl, you know, Elvis, one year they had a big magic trick and you had to put on 3D glasses and it was sponsored by Pepsi. Yeah, and it was Elvis Presto, a solid gold dancer who I think had been a little down on his luck but got this gig. And it was just, it was incoherent. She was longing for the days. It's always easy to look backwards. But she felt that Tommy had gotten his due and it made her sad. And, we spent a nice afternoon together just looking through some old scrapbooks.
Hmm. Well, that essay is a really, lovely piece. I think it has also appeared in the pages of the magazine itself. I remember reading at least something like it in Sports Illustrated. It was fun to return to it and learn so much about this aspect. And, of course, we want to remind people that the book, by and large, focuses mostly on the game of football and the way that it is played. And, of course, we hear not only about the luminaries who have made such a huge impact on the game, but also hear great stories about obscure players who have also figured one way or another. I think you tell us the story of a Green Bay Packer by the name of Max McGee, who scored the first touchdown in the first Super Bowl and had a little too much to drink the night before. Was that a story in your essay?
You know, I have at various times returned to the cautionary tale of Max McGee. I'm sure all Packers fans are familiar. For whatever reason, it's his account was one that that my people, the Murphys, I don't know, just sort of related to. But it's always be ready if you're a backup. But same, Don Beebe. I remember tracking down Don Beebe, the Buffalo Bill, who gave the Bills their only highlight in a rout. The Cowboys were just taking it to them, and Leon Lett had recovered a fumble, or perhaps he was rumbling 50-some yards with an interception return, but he held the ball out early, celebrating, and Don Beebe stripped him, and the Cowboys were not able to run up the score. And so I got Don Beebe and Leon Lett together to just talk about what the play had meant. And that was one of the reasons that Super Bowl wasn't sort of at the very bottom, because it had a memorable play.
Well, of course, we can look back over the rich history of the Super Bowl and all of the memorable plays that have been part of this great game in this really terrific book. Again, it's called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. It comes to us from the good folks of Sports Illustrated with a really interesting introduction by Austin Murphy. Austin Murphy, thank you for being so generous with your time, and congrats to you and your colleagues at Sports Illustrated for putting together this terrific book worthy of the assignment.
Thank you. I've done a lot of these hits, and nobody has really done their homework the way you have. And so I'm respecting you and thanking you for the incisive questions.
Appreciate it. Well, thank you so much. And it's a minute before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. A quick word about this weekend's podcasts of the morning show. Yesterday was Nan Calvert's last official visit to the morning show in honor of her 18 years of assistance with the morning show. We're going to replay some of our favorite Nan Calvert morning shows from the past on the Saturday and Sunday podcasts of the morning show. For the rest of the month, look for the morning show with Greg Berg. Today's going to be sunny, windy, very mild, a high of 53 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 31. Tomorrow, Saturday, not as warm as today, a high of 39 degrees. A similar forecast on Sunday as well. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.